is between the two countries. Pakistan's foreign minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs.
We agreed on time frames for the PTA, which is to be negotiated between the two countries, and an ambitious target of 6 months has been set for that process.
The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said the 21st session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish border markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future. Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
North Korea launched two cruise missiles into nearby waters early Wednesday morning, according to South Korean military officials. The missile shots follow South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's offer of substantial aid, with one condition. Pyongyang must give up its nuclear weapons program.
We will help the North every way we can. If the country shows us its commitment to complete denuclearization, I think we need to provide an agenda first so that we can wait for its answer. And this will also enable us to have meaningful talks with North Korea in the future for the establishment of peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Some South Koreans view the previous summits between progressive former President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as empty shows for the cameras. For North Korea, the offer of aid from the conservative new President Yoon suffers from questionable timing.
Coupled with the fact that South Korea and the U.S. are about to stage war games, it seems highly unlikely that North Korea is even going to respond to South Korea's offer. The U.S. and South Korea have not staged field exercises in years, and obviously North Korea is outraged at what's going to happen.
The U.S. and South Korea have been engaging in frequent small-scale military drills since South Korean President Yoon took office. The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to begin on August 22nd and will be the largest in about 4 years. Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. This year's maneuvers will include an amphibious landing. The upcoming drills will also involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group and strategic weapons. The South's Yoon also said he hoped to strengthen the U.S. extended deterrence commitment to defend South Korea with nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The sizzling temperatures have cooled off in the UK, but the inflation rate is only heating up. Prices are going up everywhere, as inflation, this time driven by food price hikes, jumps to its highest level since 1982, coming in at more than 10%. Millions of families across Britain are now trying to make their money stretch, but it's getting harder by the day.
My weekly, my monthly, everything's shop is increasing. I'm shopping right now, whilst I'm at work, to just save time. Because not only is your time money, but we don't really have much of that thing called money.
I am having to budget myself, limit myself, to try and ensure that my wage lasts the whole month, considering I'm having to pay for petrol, bills, rent, it does all add up.
It's harder for me to afford things because, you know, I don't have the steady income like most people do in London.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect inflation storm caused by a number of factors. Brexit and the delays and disruptions it has caused to the supply chain, the pandemic, and the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine.
The UK economy reopened suddenly after COVID, creating bottlenecks at ports compounded by post-Brexit red tape, followed by astronomical energy prices resulting from a decision to wean the UK from Russian energy. Inside the UK, that has translated into higher transport and packaging costs, soaring energy and food prices. That means bills getting more and more expensive in supermarkets, restaurants, and gas stations, feeding the demand for higher pay, which adds further to business costs, which turns into even higher prices. And it is that demand for wage increases that's seen multiple public sector strikes in recent weeks. It's a worsening mess that some economists say is in large part the UK government's own doing.
The answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle.
All this at a time when the UK awaits a new prime minister. Whoever they may be, they have their job cut out for them. Sai Puriza, London.
A year ago, the United States marked a chaotic end to 20 years of war in Afghanistan, following a hurried pullout of troops that saw the Taliban reclaiming power in the country. Here in Tehran, Iranian officials and political analysts sat together to discuss different aspects of the incident. They regard Washington's exit as an escape from the Afghan quagmire after it failed to achieve its geostrategic objectives there.
Today, the significance of Afghanistan has not diminished in the eyes of the Americans. They didn't leave the country to let China, Russia, and Iran invest in it. The U.S. had to leave because it totally failed there. But it will continue to make the best of its efforts to destabilize Afghanistan.
Last year, in late August, the U.S. evacuated thousands of troops from Afghanistan in just a few days, following President Joe Biden's order to exit fully by August 30, 2021. The withdrawal marked the end of two decades of war in Afghanistan, which sought to bring peace to the country, but left a trail of chaos and mayhem.
The United States not only did not fight terrorism during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan, but had a role in many acts of terrorism to legitimize and prolong its presence there.
1 year after the U.S. pullout, Afghanistan is still bogged down in turmoil. The country has been the scene of recurrent terrorist attacks, some of which have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Iran says the U.S. has resorted to Daesh to wage a proxy war in Afghanistan to make up for its losses.
The U.S. continues to back terrorists such as Daesh to destabilize Afghanistan. Aside from Daesh, it has been hosting some 7,000 Afghan military forces from the previous Afghan army to train them. What's the goal of such military trainings?
Since the Taliban takeover, Iran has been calling for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan as the ultimate way out of the persisting instability in the war-torn country.
Experts here describe the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan a lasting shame for America and the worst fiasco after its loss in the 1950s Vietnam War. They say the chaotic exit is also a lesson for the region that wherever Washington has set foot, it has left nothing but mess and destruction for the hosting nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory. Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
Business Roundtable aims to weaken efforts that would enable investors to hold companies accountable for their climate promises. We now present you an article written by Adam Lowenstein under the heading, How a Top US Business Lobby Promised Climate Action but Worked to Block Efforts. Three years ago, in a statement, America's most powerful and politically connected corporations promised to protect the environment by embracing sustainable practices across American businesses. The statement on the purpose of a corporation came from the Business Roundtable, an influential Washington, D.C. lobbying group whose 200-plus members include the chief executives of some of the world's biggest companies, such as Apple, Pepsi, Walmart, and Google. Now, on the statement's third anniversary, the Business Roundtable and its member CEOs continue to issue earnest statements about the climate crisis. But the organization is also working diligently and spending liberally to weaken efforts that would enable investors to hold companies accountable for their climate promises. An analysis by The Guardian found the lobby group has worked hard to protect the status quo in which corporations generate goodwill and positive public relations by publishing bold climate goals with little fear of being held accountable or legally liable for achieving those goals. Can choose to selectively disclose certain parts of their carbon footprint or none at all. Are not required to reveal the greenhouse gas emissions generated throughout their supply chains, which for most companies make up the majority of their emissions. Make high-profile pledges to fight climate change while paying to maintain memberships in the Business Roundtable and other trade associations that spend millions of dollars to lobby governments against meaningful climate action. In public, The Business Roundtable's leaders are still committed to change. Doug McMillan, the chief executive officer of Walmart and previous chair of the Business Roundtable, has claimed the climate crisis one of the greatest challenges facing the planet today. In a statement on the group's website, Mary Barra, the chief executive officer of General Motors and the Roundtable's current chair, declared that we must act to tackle climate change. Johnson Controls chief executive officer George Oliver, in a video published by the Business Roundtable in January, said the challenge isn't a lack of business commitment, adding, "What we need is to be aligned with the public sector to make sure that we've got the proper policies in place that will enable us to do what we do so well." Yet when the US government has tried to put the proper policies in place, the Business Roundtable has worked to undermine those efforts. In 2021, the organization spent millions of dollars to stop the Biden administration's Build Back Better agenda, which included significant efforts to purportedly reduce carbon emissions and promote clean energy. And this year, after the US Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, proposed a long-anticipated rule that would require publicly held companies to disclose their carbon emissions and the risk that climate change poses to their business models, the Business Roundtable declared its opposition to central aspects of the Securities and Exchange Commission proposal, including provisions that experts say are vital for the rule to give investors comparable and consistent information about corporations' climate risks. Before releasing the proposed rules in March, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, had asked the public what such rules might look like. In its response, the Business Roundtable acknowledged that climate challenges are creating growing risks in many parts of the economy and deemed it appropriate for the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, to regulate climate disclosures. The group admitted that the present system of corporate climate reporting, in which some companies issue voluntary climate-related disclosures, has proven inadequate. But when the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, shifted from requesting voluntary input to proposing mandatory requirements for climate disclosures, the organization appeared to change its tune. In a 17-page letter, the chief executive officer, Lobby, announced its opposition to the proposal and asked the commission to revise and repropose the rule. In an email to The Guardian, the Business Roundtable denied that its perspective had changed. It claimed, "Business Roundtable members are committed to combating climate change and are supportive of a rulemaking." The group said, "Our goal is for a pragmatic, attainable and successful rule," adding, "Our members believe it is worth the extra time on the front end to repropose the rule." According to meeting memoranda published by the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, since April of 2021, the Business Roundtable has met at least three times with the SEC about climate disclosures. According to reports compiled by Open Secrets, in the first half of this year, the group sent more than $9.1 million lobbying the federal government directly. In its public disclosures, the Roundtable reported lobbying Congress, the White House, and the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Council, about the climate disclosure proposal. In an email, the Business Roundtable said it met with the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, to directly communicate their concerns and shared their point of view with members of Congress and administration officials. Despite asking for a new and thus delayed proposal, the organization's own members continue to assure the public that they see the climate crisis as an urgent challenge. Cummins, chief executive officer and Business Roundtable member Tom Linebarger, said in the organization's January climate video, We're out of time. We're getting ready to get ready to do things. And the problem is that we have to move now. But now, it seems, does not mean now. One provision the Business Roundtable has rejected as unworkable is a requirement for companies to measure and report the greenhouse gas emissions generated by their suppliers and customers throughout their supply chains, or what are known as Scope 3 emissions. The provision would apply only to companies that have published emission targets that include Scope 3, or for which supply chain emissions are considered material. Scope 3 includes all greenhouse gas emissions that companies neither generate directly, Scope 1, nor purchase for their own energy needs, Scope 2, which means everything from the raw materials that go into creating a product to the transportation that delivers that product to a consumer. For most companies, Scope 3 emissions represents the majority of their carbon output. As Adisu Lashitu, a fellow at Brookings Institution, has pointed out, more than three-quarters of Amazon's 2021 emissions were considered Scope 3. The Business Roundtable supports mandating Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions disclosures, and many companies already report them, in part because these direct emissions are easier to calculate and easier to reduce, sometimes through the purchase of dubious carbon offsets. In its comments to the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, the Business Roundtable called the proposal to require companies to measure and report Scope 3 emissions overly burdensome, because many companies still have limited systems in place to identify and disclose Scope 3 emissions, and some aspects of reporting value chain emissions remain challenging. But Alison Heron-Lee, the former acting chair and commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC, told The Guardian, "If you don't have Scope 3 as a requirement, then what you have effectively done is cut out most of the emissions from the top emitting industries, with emissions arguably being the most important item of disclosure for investors. How is a rule without Scope 3 going to achieve what investors need?" The Business Roundtable said in an email, "There is an inherent degree of uncertainty in some of the data the proposal would require companies to disclose, and much of it is largely outside of their control." A number of experts familiar with the Securities and Exchange Council's climate disclosure rulemaking acknowledge that tracking and reporting Scope 3 emissions could indeed be difficult for some companies, or at least more difficult than not doing so. But they suggested that the more fundamental question was not whether complying with the SEC's rules would be more difficult than doing nothing, but rather if doing so would provide investors with information that they have requested, and that would help them make more informed investment decisions. This argument would appear to align with the stated position of the Business Roundtable, which has repeatedly expressed its support for market-based efforts to address climate change, a view it reiterated in its comments to the Securities and Exchange Council, SEC. George S. Georgiev, a professor at Emory University in Georgia and an expert on securities law, told The Guardian, "Information is the lifeblood of the capital markets, and capital markets are a central institution of a capitalist market economy," adding, "Climate-related financial information is demanded by investors, not by environmentalists." In its comments, the Business Roundtable said that its member companies had already set a high bar for voluntary environmental, social and governance disclosures, or ESG disclosures, and that a voluntary approach to climate reporting was already providing more valuable information for investors. But many investors, analysts and academics, voters and experts, even companies themselves, disagree. Emory University's Georgiev said, "There is near universal agreement among scholars that voluntary disclosure rules alone are not sufficient. The same logic applies to climate rules."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Operation against Ukraine continues. This is while the U.S. military support also continues unabated, with the latest support equaling almost another $1 billion. Meanwhile, sanctions and condemnations against Russia have never stopped. For example, the U.K. has stated that Russia has no moral right to sit at the Group of 20 Nations. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll look at where things stand, especially when it comes to the battered European economies, many facing energy shortfalls, or majority of them, coming before the upcoming winter season ahead. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. From the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders joins us from New York. Also joining us is contributor at the Schiller Institute, Karel Veriken, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Sarah Flounders, let me first start with you. Trying to keep up with the pace, let alone the numbers, in terms of the dollar amount from the U.S. in the form of military support for Ukraine. Another one, $775 million, $9 billion since the conflict began, and is part of a huge $40 or $50 billion military package. What do you make of this massive military support that the U.S. is sending, which is said to be the largest arms transfer in U.S. history by some accounts?
Is this to me?
Yes, Sarah Flounders.
Well, it is an enormous, enormous subsidy to U.S. arms manufacturers. That's what it is, first and foremost. It's not meant in any defense of the people of Ukraine, who are being used as pawns in a proxy war. And it is devastating for them. It's also devastating right back here. But it is a U.S. instigated effort to recap their hegemony in the world, which is rapidly fading. And so they are willing to pump billions and billions of dollars, which are payments, as I say, to the military industries here at great profit, and ship some of it. A lot of it just gets lost, resold, repackaged, but some of it gets shipped to the Ukraine. And at the same time, it is creating enormous economic hardship in Europe, because the sanctions, which go right along with the weapons packages, are devastating throughout the world. And it's meant to create hardship, but that is what the U.S. is willing to do in an effort to recapture its position.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Carell, if we can, about what the U.S. has sent in this latest batch. And I'm particularly zooming in on these launchers by the name of HIMARS, which are not the typical, launch vehicles that were used prior. But now, recently, the U.S. has actually sent it as part of their military package, 16 to be the latest batch. Because the U.S. has actually limited that number, fearing that it's going to maybe lead to the U.S. endangering its own national security. It's pretty astounding that the U.S. is going to such limits to provide Ukraine with military assistance, isn't it, when it's looking at equipment that may actually endanger U.S.'s own national security?
Well, it does, because many wars, world wars, can also start very easily by errors of evaluation. And of course, the French Caesar cannons are already a problem, although their reach is a little bit shorter. The HIMARS and also the, especially because they imply a lot of intelligence and assistance with radar equipment. And there, in reality, according to certain sources, there have been already strikes of by these weapon system on Russian territory itself, and then also in Crimea, which Ukraine will still pretend it is part of Ukraine, while in reality Crimea has decided to join the Russian Federation. So It is an escalation towards making Russia and also Europe co-belligerent actors in the war. And it is only the cold blood, the calculation of the Russian military, which so far has kept things on a low level. Also, the HIMARS was used to eliminate about 100 or at least half of the 100 arrested military forces of the Azov Brigade, which were in a special prison, and which, of course, were not eliminated by the Russians themselves because they were set to speak before the tribunal and to tell what really happened. And they most probably, most likely, were eliminated with a strike from a missile to prevent them from speaking up.
All right. There's something that's really, I'm not too sure what to make of it. I'm going to call it, in a sense, shocking, Sarah Flounders, that came from the Pentagon. And I'd like to find out if you can make this out. The Pentagon has come out within the same setting, saying that right now, there, according to the statement, a complete and total lack of progress has been made by the Russians on the battlefield. But then the same organization and the person from the Pentagon has said, when pressed by the reporters, that the Ukrainians lacked sufficient troops and combat power to drive the Russians from their defensive positions. This is in complete contradiction and contrast to the stance that the Pentagon has claimed within one setting. What do you make of it?
Well, I think I would make the same thing. Were the statements any different on Afghanistan right until the day before the U.S. was driven out? They were winning. They claimed it again and again in every public relations statement, and they demanded that Afghan officials also say the situation is being reversed. Didn't mean that it was. And so we've always seen this declaration of victory being just around the corner, when in fact, that's not what's happening. And as long as they can sell the weapons, pump the weapons in, as far as they are concerned, they're winning. They must find wars in order to make the super profits that the military industries are really built on. And they must justify the wars. So that really becomes a self-perpetuating claim. And it is very difficult to know what's actually happening from anything in the U.S. media, because they intentionally don't explain the reason for the war and what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, they claim to care a great deal about the people of the Ukraine. They really are into totally using the people of the Ukraine, and organizing and funding for years fascist or Nazi forces in the Ukraine.
Karel, if I can ask you about this, it's almost the same question, but when you look at the numbers and the different analysis on Ukraine's military might, there seems to be a consensus on the fact that there's not enough manpower to defend Ukraine or to even be offensive against Russia, but that Ukraine needs equipment. The president has said that. So this kind of puts the focus on the equipment side of things. But we're talking about nuclear-powered Russia. The president has said, Vladimir Putin, nuclear weapons will not be used. But if pressed, and especially if they're looking after Crimea in what's supposed to be this big counteroffensive, do you think there's a possibility that that risks Russia using nuclear weapons of some kind?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to really predict that this will happen or not. It is, in reality, what Sarah Flanders is saying is true. We're all being lied already on the initial strategy of Russia. Russia never intended to, and that's why they say it's a military operations, because in reality they don't want to invade the entirety of Ukraine and occupy it for forever. You know, that's not absolutely not their aim. Secondly, according to the best estimates from the French military and US military, it's there are three times more Ukrainian soldiers than Russian soldiers. So it's a pure lie to say that in terms of numbers, Ukrainians have much more people, which they are very badly trained and low qualified. but they have more people. That's true. And Russia is just taking time to let things work out and is expecting that at one point or another it will be very simply things will run out. And there is an inside division in the U.S., as we have seen with the declaration of Henry Kissinger, which is not my favorite at all, but who is somehow a realist, of including a realist for a U.S. strategic interests, where he said, you know, that Biden administration is bringing the U.S. in a war with Russia and China into things which the U.S. has partly played on, but nobody knows how this is going to end. So even people like Kissinger, which are not real humanists, you know, are afraid that this whole thing could go out of control, and that at one point or another, there was a call by former U.S. military, the most lunatic elements, which were calling for increased weaponry and increasing, it's not only the quantity, but increasingly more offensive weapons. And that will at one point be used directly against Belarus and Russia. And at that point, then, of course, indeed, Russia could use nuclear strike as an answer. So we're sleepwalking into a big conflict if there is no wake-up call to get this thing under control.
Our guest talks about how things are getting to the point where it's out of control, Sarah Flounders. But aren't things out of control right now when you're looking at, for example, incident concerns Germany, where Gazprom has again announced another halt to its gas flow to Germany. Reports of Germany being deindustrialized and that they need to ration electricity. I mean, that to me sounds like things have gotten out of control just on one European country. What do you think?
Well, things are certainly out of control within the European economy. Britain also, they're feeling the impact of the sanctions that have boomeranged back on them. It's also hitting here, not as sharply right now, but we're feeling it also. Russia, who is self-sufficient in grain, in energy, in cereals, and a lot of resources, and a great deal of industrial infrastructure, is able to survive these very harsh sanctions and is setting up new banking transactions with other countries. On the other hand, the European Union suddenly finds itself without energy that they absolutely need to fuel their industries and homes and heating and air conditioning and everything that you need in summer and winter. And every single country is feeling the shortages, with crazy messages to the populations to shower less and turn out your lights and so on. This won't solve the problems in Europe, but it really means that the sanctions are coming back and hitting them hard because they don't have an alternative to the gas and the oil that they previously exported and used in great quantity and at great advantageous to their own industries. And this is what the U.S. wants to break, because there was 10 times more trade, for example, between Germany and Russia than with the U.S. Well, they want to reverse that and close the door on trade with Russia. It is devastating for the German economy and most of the other countries in Europe that are going along with the sanctions.
Still don't understand how this can actually happen, Corral, when we take a look at the fact that there's still European countries that are purchasing gas and oil from Russia. Germany is still doing that. The Netherlands is still doing that. There are many others that are still doing that with that scheme of how they need to, exchange the euros into rubles and deposit it in one of the Russian banks, Gazprom, I believe. So you know, that doesn't go with the way that the EU is promoting its all-out sanctions war with Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, it's and it reveals the completely hypocritical system which this EU has become, because they are facing, officially they want to have an embargo, but in practice they will, it will take months and years, and even then, you know, we have I mean, there's a lot of oil bought from India, which is shipped somewhere else, and then it ends up even back in the United States, you know. So the whole facade of things, I mean, this is the craziness of things. They decide things which are absolutely impossible to put into practice, and because they, for example, Renault, you know, the French car industry, they sold their assets for a symbolical sum of money, sold it to the Russians, and then, but they have a special deal that they can buy it back for the same price in the next 6 years, because they expect at that point, you know, maybe the war will be ended and things could be back to normal. So there is, but there is a real clash between the political elites, which are completely insane, and the other on the side, the real people and the economic interests, even the, which are really in shock. And also because the sanctions will not only hit Europe, but a lot of countries to which Europe, if you take, for example, Cambodia, you know, they buy 60%. If they have to apply the sanctions, you know, this will completely screw up supply lines for the entire Western economy. So it's, and I'm not even speaking about the food riots, which can happen any day at this point.
August 18, 2022, Sarah Flanders, Diplomacy Watch. Talks to end the war are back on the agenda. This is what one of the headline reads, confirmed by some other ones. However, actions speak louder than words. When you hear about the $785 million of weaponry that the U.S. sold, doesn't sound like diplomacy is back on the agenda or on the table. But in the bigger picture, 6 months, how much diplomacy was on that scale on the left, and how much military talk of war was on the other side of the scale? Why isn't there such a push for a diplomatic solution to this conflict, do you think?
Well, frankly, the U.S. is not interested in a diplomatic solution anywhere in the world. And every treaty, every agreement they have ever made, they have violated. This is true whether it's Iran or Russia or China or the indigenous nations of the U.S. or the countries of Latin America. They do use diplomacy from time to time, but only in terms of aggressively planning the next wars. And their interest, their bottom line interest, is in using their military and economic power to maintain their world domination. That is what is slipping, because countries around the world have reached a certain industrial and technical capacity to trade and exchange with each other. That is a big change. Before this, the dollar was all powerful, and there was no way, once you were cut off from the SWIFT banking, to do some of the simplest transactions. But now, countries have found there's all forms of digital currency. In China with the SWIFT, the CIPS, in Russia with the SPSF, there's mere credit cards. There's all kinds of ways that countries are finding to arrange exchanges for the resources that they need outside of the sanctions that are being imposed by the U.S. as an effort to shut this down. They want each country on their own to starve. That is the purpose of sanctions, is to inflict the greatest pain on the civilian population. And countries are finding ways to survive, to exchange, to trade with each other. And it's the sanctioned countries that are actually showing the way, showing that they can survive. Determination internally and exchange with each other.
Along those lines, Correll, the news came out today that Russia will move away from the dollar, euro, and SWIFT in its trade with partners, as it stated. And it said it's something that has been going on for quite some time. Many people don't realize Russia was actually under heavy sanctions that really initiated back in 2014 by the U.S., and then some European countries followed. How much will it take? How much longer will this take? And are we looking at the BRICS countries as an example, and then for other countries that are in the China-Russia camp to really get this trade going in their national currencies, which obviously will impact the U.S. dollar and its status one form or another?
Well, Lionel LaRouche, with which I worked over a long period, was very much interested in this process, especially since 1971, when the U.S. Suspended the convertibility of the dollar to gold. And then there was first in Europe with the European snake, a defensive mechanism to be sheltered and to be protected against a dollar, which became a dollar of the international speculative caste, which is not anymore a dollar of the U.S. as such. It's run by an international banksters and not anymore one country as such. But now it was very interesting that including Iran has been proposing to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to find new ways to build a basket of physical goods, which could be the basis for a new monetary system. So there's first an increase, a move out of the IMF system, or you can call it move out of the dollar.
Okay.
Increase of mutual trade between Russia, India, Iran, especially through the north-south transport corridor, which is very important. A new trade route opening up. And then in the next phase, this could actually become some kind of new monetary system or a new Bretton Woods, not any longer based on the dollar, but based on an agreement among countries for mutual development.
I'd like to give you just 30 seconds, please, Sarah Flounders. What has the U.S. gained from this when Russia just came out and said it will be selling its arms that it finds significantly superior to Western arms, to its allies? Doesn't that endanger U.S. national security in some sense by this move? 30 seconds, please.
Well, all of this endangers the security of the entire globe. It's very short-sighted, immediate decisions for what's the most immediately profitable, and we pay the long-term costs.
Very well.
So stay up and finding new ways to resist.
Thank you.
More important.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry to jump in. Sarah Flounders, International Action.